From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We could not survive because we were poor. We came here to make a living, to work. But when we worked, they exploited us.
One of the victims of the largest immigration raids in U.S. history, when nearly 400 workers at a meatpacking plant in Pottsville, Iowa, were arrested in May. Many were sent to prison. We'll be joined by the Spanish language court interpreter. He describes the scene as the saddest procession he's ever witnessed. But first, the Marines bar an embedded photographer after he publishes a photograph of a dead U.S. soldier. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve have unveiled sweeping steps to possibly bail out the nation's two largest mortgage lenders, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said the government would inject billions of federal dollars into the mortgage groups and pledge to buy stakes in the two companies should market conditions worsen.
As you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac play a central role in our housing finance system and must continue to do so in their current form as shareholder-owned companies. Their support for the housing market is particularly important as we work through the current housing correction.
Many economists fear a collapse of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac could lead to a meltdown in global financial markets. The two quasi-public companies own or guarantee just under half the country's $12 trillion in mortgage debt. Shares of the two companies dropped about 45% last week and are down more than 80% over the past year. The Financial Times reports an outright government takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac could increase the national debt by $5 trillion. In other economic news, the banking industry was dealt a shock on Friday with the collapse of the Pasadena-based IndyMac Bank. On Friday, the FDIC took control of the bank after it succumbed to huge losses from defaulted mortgages. Regulators say it was the second largest bank failure in U.S. history. The chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has filed genocide charges against the Sudanese president, Omar al-Bashir. The charges filed today include masterminding attempts to wipe out African tribes in Darfur with a campaign of murder, rape, and deportation. Prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo is asking a three-judge panel to issue an arrest warrant for al-Bashir to prevent the deaths of those still under attack in Darfur from government-backed Janjaweed militia. On Sunday, thousands of supporters of al-Bashir rallied in Khartoum to show support for the Sudanese president. Sudan has said an ICC move against its highest officials could undermine attempts to end the conflict in Darfur. The African Union has also voiced concern that a possible trial could jeopardize peace efforts in Darfur. A secret report by the International Red Cross warned the Bush administration last year that the CIA's treatment of prisoners categorically constituted torture and could make officials who approved the torture methods guilty of war crimes. One prisoner, Abu Zubaydah, told the Red Cross he'd been waterboarded at least 10 times in a single week. He was confined in a box so small he had to double up his limbs in the fetal position. The details about the secret Red Cross report appear in a new book by investigative journalist Jane Mayer called The Dark Side. Mayer also reveals the Bush administration ignored warnings from the CIA 6 years ago that up to a third of the prisoners at Guantanamo may have been imprisoned by mistake. In 2002, a CIA analyst concluded that many of the prisoners were essentially bystanders who'd been swept up in dragnets or turned over to the U.S. military by bounty hunters. Mayer also reveals the CIA is investigating whether its agents kidnapped at least six innocent men and held them in secret prisons as part of the agency's extraordinary rendition prisons. Only one of the cases, that of Khalid al-Masri, has ever come to light. In Afghanistan, 9 U.S. soldiers died Sunday after a U.S. base near the Pakistan border came under attack. Militants fired machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, and mortars at the base for hours. It was the deadliest attack on U.S. troops in Afghanistan in 3 years. More U.S. soldiers have died in Afghanistan over the past 2 months than in Iraq. Meanwhile, in the southern province of Uruzgan, a suicide bomber on a motorcycle blew himself up and killed 24 people. In central Afghanistan, members of the Taliban executed two women who'd been accused of working as prostitutes on a U.S. base. In campaign news, Senator Barack Obama's proposing the United States deploy about 10,000 more troops to Afghanistan as part of a strategy to shift the military's focus from Iraq. In an op-ed published in today's New York Times, Obama writes, quote, "We need more troops, more helicopters, better intelligence gathering, and more non-military assistance to accomplish the mission there." In news from Iraq, The Washington Post reports U.S. and Iraqi negotiators have abandoned efforts to conclude a comprehensive agreement governing the long-term status of U.S. troops in Iraq before the end of the Bush presidency. This will effectively leave talks over an extended U.S. military presence in Iraq to the next administration. On Saturday, Senator Obama said the U.S. should not commit to a long-term occupation of Iraq. He said recent comments by Iraqi leaders calling for a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops add weight to his stand in favor of a timetable.
John McCain and George Bush both said that if Iraq as a sovereign government stated that it was time for us to start withdrawing our troops, then they would respect wishes of that sovereign government, given that I think it's also in our strategic interests, it certainly strikes me that we shouldn't be writing a status of forces agreement, for example, that locks in a long-term occupation.
In other campaign news, The New Yorker magazine is coming under criticism for publishing a cover illustration depicting Barack and Michelle Obama as Muslim terrorists. The magazine cover shows Obama wearing Muslim garb, standing in the White House with a photo of Osama bin Laden on the wall and an American flag burning in the fireplace. Michelle Obama is shown as a gun-toting black nationalist with an afro. An Obama campaign spokesperson described the illustration as tasteless and offensive. The New Yorker magazine says the illustration is meant to satirize the use of scare tactics and misinformation in the presidential election to derail Obama's campaign. John McCain's campaign is trying to distance itself from former Senator Phil Gramm, who's been one of McCain's top economic advisors. Last week, Gramm said the country was filled with, quote, whiners, and that the United States is only in a, quote, mental recession. Over the weekend, two key McCain advisors said Gramm no longer speaks on behalf of McCain. A former Bush administration official who now works as a lobbyist has been caught on tape selling access to the White House. An undercover video shot by the Sunday Times of London shows the lobbyist, Stephen Payne, saying he could help the former president of Kyrgyzstan set up a meeting with Vice President Cheney or Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in exchange for a six-figure donation to George Bush's presidential library. Stephen Payne was a top fundraiser for President Bush and sits on the influential advisory council to the Department of Homeland Security. Payne's also president of the lobbying company Worldwide Strategic Partners. The Indonesian East Timorese Commission of Truth and Friendship is set to release a report that blames the Indonesian government and armed forces for the wave of deadly violence that swept East Timor in 1999 ahead of Timor's vote on independence. The report is scheduled to be released Tuesday, but a copy was obtained by Al Jazeera. Up to 1,500 people were killed and 300,000 forced to flee their homes during the 1999 violence in what was then Indonesian-ruled East Timor. The commission's report says gross human rights violations took place, pointing the finger at pro-Indonesian militia groups, Indonesia's military, its civilian government, and police. In Japan, about 13,000 protesters gathered Sunday to condemn plans for the U.S. to permanently station a nuclear-powered warship near Tokyo. The USS George Washington is set to become the first U.S. Navy nuclear-powered vessel to station permanently in Japan. Safety concerns are mounting after a recent fire aboard the ship left one sailor with minor burns and 23 others with heat stress. Former White House press secretary and political commentator Tony Snow has died at the age of 53 following a long battle with colon cancer. Snow is survived by his wife and three children under the age of 15. Members of the peace group Code Pink took to the water last week to protest a House resolution that calls for a naval blockade against Iran. Members of Code Pink used three canoes and an inflatable raft to set up a blockade of their own to surround the houseboat of Democratic Congressmember Gary Ackerman of New York. This is Code Pink's Medea Benjamin.
It's 7 o'clock in the morning. It's time for him to get up, smell the coffee, know the American people are sick and tired of war. We're already in one quagmire in Iraq. We don't want another one in Iran.
Code Pink was calling on Ackerman to oppose House Resolution 362 and to tone down his rhetoric against Iran. And the Green Party has nominated former Democratic Congressmember Cynthia McKinney to be the party's presidential nominee. The Greens also nominated hip-hop activist and organizer Rosa Clemente to be McKinney's running mate. McKinney spoke on Saturday at the Green Party convention in Chicago.
And when I got to Washington, I saw that public policy is really made in a room at a table. There were real seats at the table. Well, imagine what has happened to public policy making now. There is a real room with a window and a door, and there's two seats at the table. The window is for us to look through while our representatives make policy for us so we can see what they're doing. At the table, one seat is for the Democrats, one seat is for the Republicans. Now, we don't know who did it, but one of them put a lock on the door and slipped a key to the corporate lobbyists who can come and go at will and whisper what they want to Democrats and Republicans. And the result is that we, the people who pay for those seats and determine who sits in them, want one thing. But because the corporate lobbies can come and go at will, our values get overridden and our representatives give us something else. That's how we end up with everyone saying they're against the war and occupation, but war and occupation still gets funding. That's how we end up with everyone saying they're against illegal spying on innocent people, yet end up with a telecom immunity bill being signed into law. That's how we end up with everyone saying they're in favor of universal access to health care and no one supporting what the physicians, nurses, and health care providers really want, and that's a single-payer health care system in this country.
Former Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney is now the Green Party presidential candidate. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An American photojournalist who is embedded with the Marines in Fallujah has been barred from the Marine Corps because of graphic photographs showing Marines killed in a suicide bombing last month. The June 26th attack on a Fallujah City Council meeting between local sheikhs and U.S. military officials killed three Marines, two interpreters, and 20 Iraqis. A few days after the bombing, the journalist, who publishes under the name Zariah, posted some photographs of the scene on his blog at www.zariah.net. A few hours later, a high-ranking public affairs official ordered him to remove the blog post. When Zariah refused, he was told his embed had been terminated and he would be flown out of Iraq. In his blog posting introducing the photograph, Zariah wrote, quote, "What I saw was abhorrently graphic, yet far too important for the world to ignore. I present images that provide an uncensored view of a terrible event and some small measure of dignity to those who lost their lives." In a later posting, he wrote, quote, "How can things change if all that comes out of Iraq are sanitized whitewash images of war designed for mainstream media outlets who focus on making money, not on the quality and truth in what they report?" After meeting with high-level officials in Iraq, Zariah now retains his credentials, but he's still barred from documenting U.S. Marine operations. Zariah returned to the United States and joins me now from Littleton, Colorado. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about what happened? Talk about the day you photographed you took the photographs that you posted.
Sure. It was actually my first day embedded with the Marine Corps. I'd been in Iraq for several weeks already documenting the situation from Sadr City with the U.S. Army. It was the first day of my embed with the Marines, the morning of the 26th. We were on a security patrol in Anbar province when we received radio information that just down the street from where we were conducting a raid on an Iraqi home, there had been some sort of massive blast. We immediately grabbed our equipment, our body armor, our Kevlar, and ran down the street about a block away from the location of the city council meeting. We started seeing people screaming and running and just a general chaos. The soldier I was running next to and I looked on the ground and we saw a human ear on the ground. A couple feet later, we saw what appeared to be possibly a skull cap with hair. And as we got closer to the building, we just saw more and more body parts and realized that what we were about to witness would be.
We're talking to Zaria. We may have just lost the feed to Littleton. It's back. And I do just, though, want to warn our viewers that we are going to be showing some of his graphic photographs. And for our radio listeners, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Zaria, continue with your description.
Yes. We walked around to the entrance of the building where they were holding the city council meeting that had suffered the attack. Upon walking through the door, it was just a scene of absolute horror. 20 civilians, three Marines, several interpreters were basically just lying in pieces in the courtyard of this building. It was an open-air courtyard. The soldiers, as we went in, were, I think, in just as much shock as everyone else. Several were throwing up. It was just extremely graphic. And I realized at that moment that it was a situation that I could very likely be removed from, knowing, you know, stories that several other journalists have told me about trying to photograph under similar circumstances while embedded, and that the soldiers, the Marines, really do not like this kind of information, especially when it's their own that have been injured or killed, to be released. So I immediately began to take as many pictures as I possibly could, which was a very good decision because I was only allowed about 5, maybe 7 minutes inside where the bomb blast had happened before I was told that I needed to leave the area. I was told it was for my own safety. I protested. I said, I'm not worried about my own safety. I'm here to do my job. I'm here to document, but they insisted. I ended up spending about an hour and a half or 2 hours locked inside of an armored vehicle. And I was finally allowed back into the scene and told at that point that I was not allowed to take any more photos. I could stand by if I wanted to and be witness, but I was not allowed to use my camera anymore at that point. My protests didn't do anything. I tried to have them radio a higher command or a public affairs officer to, you know, get verification that I was allowed to take pictures of the scene, but that didn't happen. Later that day, when we returned to a base, one of the Marines told me that they needed to have me erase my memory cards and actually hand my memory cards over. At that point, I refused to do that. And it was not taken any further at that point. I waited the 24 hours for family to be notified as per the media ground rules for embedded photographers or journalists. Yeah, you're not allowed to release any information until family has been notified. The next day, Friday the 27th, we got word that all the family members had been notified. And I still spent the next 3 days giving some extra time, knowing that the images I had taken were extremely graphic and would be hard for people to look at. And organizing my post on my blog so that if the family members or anyone else that knew these men happened to go on the blog by accident, they would actually have to read a disclaimer and go to a second page where the images were below the fold of the screen and there were more warnings about the graphic content and about the event. I ended up posting the blog on the evening of the 30th, and within several hours after posting it, I received a call from senior PAO officials, public affairs officials, saying that they wanted my blog taken down completely, the entire blog, which I immediately refused to do. And within 10 minutes of refusing to remove my blog, they called back. They asked one more time. I asked them again what the reason for asking me to remove my blog was. And at the time, they said that I had showed Marines, injured or killed Marines, and that they were identified as Marines because of their camouflage pants and their shoes. And I said, well, there's nothing in the embed rules that say you can't show someone who's identifiable as a Marine. It says no identifiable features, you know, to identify that person from, you know, another person. But actually showing an injured soldier or a dead soldier is not something that is barred in the embed rules. They claimed it was. They claimed that I had signed something that said that this was the case. I knew that I hadn't, and within several minutes, I had gotten word that they were arranging a special convoy to remove me from the area and take me to Camp Fallujah, where there was a flight to bring me to the green zone and away from all Marine installations. Upon arrival at Camp Fallujah, I ended up being held there for 3 days. They had given me armed escorts because they feared that people on the base were so angry that I could potentially be in harm's way. The reason they claim they kept me at the base was to meet General Kelly, who was the senior commander there, who wanted to speak with me about the photos I'd taken and ask me again to take them down. The two times that I went to meet with him, he left me waiting, the first time for 2 hours, the second time for about a half an hour, and never showed up. On the third day, they arranged a special helicopter flight to the Green Zone, at which time I was flown out of the Marines' area of operation. And I assumed at that point that I would be continuing my embeds with the U.S. Army, because most journalists who do get banned or barred because of similar circumstances end up just going on another embed immediately with a different branch of the military, or sometimes just in a different area. Upon arrival in Baghdad, I was told that the Marines were pushing for my complete blacklisting in all DOD operations, any military operations, and that I would have to stand by until the situation was resolved. 3 days later, I was invited to a dinner at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, where I was told that senior public affairs officials, basically as high up in the chain of command as you can get in Iraq, had been debating my case and had been listening to the claims that the Marines had made and had not found anything that I had done to be a breach of my contract, a breach of the embed rules, and that they would allow me to keep my credentials, although there was nothing they could do as far as the Marines go. My ban and barment from the Marine Corps stood, and there was no way that that would be lifted.
We're talking to Zariah, who was an embedded photographer with the Marines when he photographed a suicide bombing. The letter that you got given the reasons for your dismissal said you photographed the remains of U.S. soldiers, you posted the images along with detailed commentary, and by posting the images and your commentary, you violated 14H&O of the news media agreement you signed. In addition, the letter said, by providing detailed information of the effectiveness of the attack and response of U.S. forces to it, you have put all U.S. forces in Iraq at greater risk for harm. Your response?
Well, first of all, I did not report or show anything that had not already been shown by the New York Times, Washington Post, Reuters, the day after the attack. There were detailed reports of the attack on all major news media, even within hours of the attack, and none of the information I had given presented any new information, and definitely no information that could be used by an enemy to plan an attack. And I've received, since this incident, several emails from military public affairs officers and former military public affairs officers from around the world who have said that they've reviewed this extensively and that there's absolutely nothing in my photographs or in my post that could be used by the enemy to gather any sort of information, and that the clause that they actually used to formally disembed me with is primarily used for people who try to photograph vehicles that have been disabled by IEDs or EFPs, explosively formed projectiles, and that this clause was made so that people would not take images of these vehicles, and thus giving the enemy specific information as to how their roadside bombs were disabling vehicles, and, you know, if the placement was correct and how to better to better place their weapons to cause more damage.
Zariah, did they want you to erase your memory card?
Yes, that was the day of the attack. They asked me to erase my memory card. They actually asked me to erase my memory card and then wanted my cameras and memory cards handed over to them. That was the first thing I refused to do. They didn't end up pushing that issue. I believe whoever it was that was pushing me to do that was told by someone else that that was absolutely not acceptable. Otherwise, I don't know why they didn't push the issue more that day.
What was the response of the Marines on the ground, of the soldiers that you were embedded with, of the Marines that you were embedded with, to what you were doing, to your photographs and to your posting them?
Well, you know, I mean, we live on a daily basis with these guys. We, you know, we develop relationships with them. We sleep in the same room. We live in the same rooms. We travel in vehicles. And, you know, we'd actually, in a way, bonded through this event. It was such a, you know, a horrific thing for all of us to witness that I felt very close to the men in my platoon, and I think they felt the same way about me. And one of the things that I did in the 3 days before I posted the blog, after the families had been notified, was work and speak with the Marines that I was staying with, asking them what they felt about the photos, if they felt that, you know, they were offensive, if they felt they were in bad taste, if they felt the post in general, you know, would be hurtful to family members, if they thought it, you know, it did more good than bad. And I had the overwhelming support, and I continue to get letters from Marines all over the world who are pledging their support and saying that they think that my being barred from the Marine Corps was absolutely out of line.
We're going to break, but when we come back, Zariah, I want to ask you about what it was you felt you had agreed to in being embedded in the Marines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Zariah is an American journalist, a war photographer, embedded with the Marines, now barred from Anbar province by them for showing the photographs of dead Marines. He photographed a suicide bombing that killed three Marines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the American photojournalist Zariah, war photographer embedded with the Marine Corps at Anbar province in Iraq, now barred for documenting the Marines because of photographs showing three Marines killed in a suicide bombing that he posted to his website. What is the agreement you make with the military, Zariah, when you are embedded? What is it that you sign?
It's called the Media Hold Harmless Agreement. There's several different clauses and several different bits of information in it. The ones that pertain to this, to my case, are First of all, you're not allowed to publish any images that have identifiable features before the family of the soldier that has been killed has been notified. And by identifiable features, it's referring to name tags, it's referring to tattoos, it's referring to clear shots that show the individual's face, and you could say, you know, I know who this person is. You know, this is something that I followed to the letter, and even beyond it, I made sure that there were no identifiable features in the post, even after the family had been notified. Like I said before, the other issue which they claimed that I had violated the official reason for the termination of my embed had been providing the enemy with information on the effectiveness of attack. You know, I don't see how you could have any photo that comes out of Iraq after an attack that, you know, they couldn't say if they wanted to that this photo or this information could potentially provide the enemy with some information that they could use. I mean, pretty much any documentation of any, you know, even where an attack had been 3 weeks ago, you could use this clause to disembed somebody, which is the really kind of disheartening thing about this, is how incredibly easy it is to remove an embedded journalist under the system that they have now. And I think another really interesting thing is the fact that the morning of, or the evening of the 30th, when I was officially notified that my embed would be terminated, the reason they gave me was that I had depicted a Marine that was injured or killed, and that was identifiable by the camouflage pants and the boots. Then 3 days later, the official in writing reason for my termination of my embed was the fact that I had provided the enemy with information on the effectiveness of an attack. By the time I got to Baghdad and the Marine Corps was pressing for my blacklist from all DOD operations and any further embeds, they were saying that I had changed a photo on the website that was originally posted, and then I changed it later. I was able to disprove that through records with Typepad, the company that hosts the blog. And then after that, they claimed that I had posted the blog before the families had been notified. And once again, we were able to use timestamps as to when the blog was published to disprove that and prove that it was literally several days after the family had gotten notification that the blog post came up. So I think it's very interesting how many times their story had changed. It makes me wonder, you know, if they were kind of grasping for straws, trying to get a reason to, you know, get me blacklisted. And I do have to say that I'm very happy that the senior officials in Baghdad were able to see through that. They specifically told me the Marines have not been able to prove anything that they have claimed against you, and that's why I'm able to keep my credentials.
Soraya, I wanted to turn now to an interview that I did with James Lee in Santa Barbara. He's a former Marine from California who served two tours of duty in Iraq in 2001 to 2004. Now he's a journalism student at San Francisco State University. He went back to Iraq earlier this year to file reports for the college newspaper. But in April, James Lee was abruptly disembedded.
My last assignment was in the city of Basra. I had become aware of a decline in the security situation in some neighborhoods around Baghdad and in Basra, and decided that I wanted to go down a photograph and to document the Iraqi army's ability or inability to conduct independent combat operations in Iraq. I arrived in Basra after a three-day convoy with Iraqi soldiers from Baghdad down to Basra. I was only in Basra about 4 hours when I was notified by the public affairs office assigned to Basra that they didn't want any Western media in Basra covering the fighting, and that an aircraft was being dispatched down to Basra to pick me up to fly me back to Baghdad.
What was the reason they gave?
Originally, I was told that an order came directly from the office of General Petraeus that they didn't want any Western media covering the events. And
why?
Because Petraeus was in Washington at the time, and they were concerned about images coming out from Basra that didn't support their mission at the time.
Is that what you speculated, or that's what they said?
That's what I was told by the public affairs officer. That's what he thought the reason was. I thought that it contradicted some guidelines that General Petraeus had published to his subordinate command directly relating to the media. And I had obtained Petraeus's personal phone number a few weeks earlier from a French reporter who had interviewed him. So I called that number, and he'd already left for Washington, but one of his adjutants had answered the phone and said that that order didn't come from Petraeus and that I had every right to remain in Basra. I notified the unit that I was with about that fact, and they changed their story and said, well, you're now able to stay. But about 2 hours later, they reversed their position and said now a new authority was ordering me out of Basra, and then it wasn't Petraeus. I was told that it was a two-star Marine general. They wouldn't identify who he was. And later, once I arrived back in Baghdad, after being forced to leave Basra, I was told that the order now came from the Iraqi army themselves. So they had quite a few reasons why I couldn't be there doing my job.
Why didn't they want you to see what was the reality on the ground?
The reality on the ground was more than 1,000 Iraqi soldiers refused to fight the Mahdi army, whether they were afraid that they didn't have the ability to do it or they didn't believe that they should be fighting the Mahdi army. For whatever reason, many of them put down their weapons and refused to go into Basra and fight the Mahdi army. And I think those images would have been very powerful, and I think it would have created a lot of doubt on the part of the American public about the Iraqi army's commitment to coalition missions in Iraq.
Former Marine James Lee went back as an embedded photographer, but then was also kicked out. Zariah, your response about his experience.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly similar, and I think the whole subject is very, very disturbing because of the power that the Department of Defense has to control the information that comes out of Iraq. I mean, because the situation, as far as security goes, is so incredibly volatile and so incredibly dangerous now, you effectively cannot work as a disembedded journalist in Iraq unless you have basically the money to have a private army in the form of a private security force to accompany you. So. Basically, your only ability to work in Iraq right now is as an embedded journalist. So with the power to disembed journalists this easily, it basically gives the Department of Defense free rein over the information that comes out of Iraq. If somebody like myself does happen to capture images that are controversial, it's very easy to make us go away, as I saw in this case. And I think James' case is extremely similar. It happened in the same area. It happened under the same general, and it just proves how easy it is to get rid of people who are a thorn in your side.
And yet you can return. The Marines have said no, but the rest of the U.S. military has not barred you.
Correct. That's correct. And that comes from, senior public affairs officials in Baghdad. I believe that we probably have Petraeus to thank for that, and I am very thankful for it. But I think another thing that's interesting to look at is the decision to accept embeds comes from the actual units in the military. So although I'm officially allowed to be embedded and to do further embeds, there's a very, very high chance that when applying for these embeds, I could be denied across the board. It would be very easy for them to, put a heads up to any of the units that are interested in embedding me that I had caused a controversy. And it would be very easy for them to just say, we're not interested in hosting him as an embed. So although I do maintain the right to be an embedded journalist, I have a feeling if I tried again, especially now or in the near future, it would be extremely difficult.
Well, I want to thank you, Zariah, for being with us again. The photos are at our website, democracynow.org. You have returned to the United States. Will you return anytime soon to Iraq?
I don't know if I'll be returning anytime soon. I have a feeling if I did that I would probably be sent to areas where I would not be in any way able to document anything. And I think it's at this point just too easy to prevent journalists from doing their work, either by keeping you in the vehicle if an incident happens or by blocking your camera if you try to photograph after the incident, by taking away your memory cards, by taking away your film, and then if you do publish the images, removing you from your embed. It's just far too difficult to work there right now.
Thanks for joining us, Zariah. And we will link
to
your website at ours at democracynow.org. Zariah joining us from Littleton, Colorado. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Tristes pasan a diario. en la frontera de México y Estados Unidos. La raza que va en busca del sueño americano tiene que enfrentarse con la misión de los polleros que los tranzan y los engañan, los atracan y los extorsionan. Cosas muy tristes pasan a diario en la frontera de México y Estados Unidos. La raza que va en busca del sueño americano.
Sueño Americano, American Dream by Eltry, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 700 stations, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish, in transcript, and in audio form for any radio station to take, as over 200 are. We turn now to Postville, Iowa, a small town of just over 2,000 people. On May 12th, the town became the site of the largest immigration raid in U.S. history. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, arrested 389 workers at Agriprocessors, the largest kosher slaughterhouse and meatpacking plant in the country. Nearly 300 of the workers were charged with aggravated identity theft and Social Security fraud. Many were sent to prison. Eric Kamide is a professor of modern languages at Florida International University in Miami. He was one of the 26 court-appointed interpreters flown into Iowa for the trial. In an account describing his experience, he wrote, quote, "Then began the saddest procession I've ever witnessed, which the public would never see, because cameras were not allowed past the perimeter of the compound. Driven single file in groups of 10, shackled at the wrists, waists, and ankles, chains dragging as they shuffled through, the slaughterhouse workers were brought in for arraignment, sat and listened through headsets to the interpreted initial appearance before marching out again to be bused to different county jails, only to make room for the next row of 10. They appeared to be uniformly no more than 5 feet tall, mostly illiterate Guatemalan peasants with Mayan last names, some in tears, others with faces of worry, fear, and embarrassment." This is one of the workers speaking in her own words.
My name is Elida, and I am from Guatemala. I have two children. I have brought them here. Because of our situation in our town in Guatemala, we could not survive because we were poor. We came here to make a living, to work. But when we worked, they exploited us. We didn't have any option but to accept the work because we knew we needed the money. I think it is very unjust what they are doing to us, because after they need the work of our hands to do this labor, now they are paying us like this. If they could only realize that all of us here are so traumatized by what happened.
Now then, We turn now to Professor Eric Hamayeh. He joins us now from Miami. We're also joined in New York by Roberto Lovato, a writer with New America Media and frequent contributor to The Nation magazine. He writes extensively on immigration politics and immigrant rights. Eric Hamayeh, describe your experience.
Well, it was a unique experience for me in my 23 years as a federal interpreter. It started with waiting around in the courtroom until they started bringing in the defendants, and they were shackled at the waist, wrist, and feet, and coming in rows of 10. Then they sat down to be arraigned. And one of the first things that struck me is that there didn't seem to be a presumption of innocence. The presumption of innocence became kind of like empty words because they were shackled. They were on an immigration detainer, so they didn't have any right to bail, like normally defendants would. That's how it started. It was a very long process that lasted 2 weeks, and as I went along day after day, there was a new irregularity in the process, and eventually, I guess there was an irregularity at every step, I would say. Comparing this process, this fast-tracking judicial proceedings, with the judicial proceedings that I've watched in federal court over 23 years of professional practice.
Can you describe for us, as you pieced it together, what actually went down in May when this raid took place, the largest immigration raid in U.S. history?
Well, the plant was stormed by what is really a paramilitary force of hundreds of agents, and they brought the detainees to the National Cattle Congress that had been prepared as a detention center. The security there was high security. And then after the initial appearance where the detainees were arraigned, we went, well, the different interpreters with their attorneys, went to the different jails in throughout eastern Iowa where the arraigned detainees had been taken. And then we met with each one individually of the ones that each attorney had assigned to and explained the plea agreement to them and went through basically an interview, fairly in-depth, with each of the clients. I think that it is important to mention that one of the things that struck me about these proceedings is that the different officers of the court did not witness the entire process from beginning to end. The interpreters did. We were there from before arraignment for the very brief attorney-client conferences in preparation for arraignment, through the arraignment, and then in the interviews in jail, in the sentencings, and in the interviews after sentencing. There were different judges doing the arraignment and the sentencing. Magistrates were doing arraignments and hearing the pleas, and then U.S. District Court judges were doing the sentencing. So there wasn't a continuity so that basically none of the other officers of the court were able to see the entire process the way that interpreters could.
Eric Hamid, can you talk about some of the people you interpreted for to give us a thumbnail sketch of who they were, like the man who walked from Guatemala to Iowa to work?
Yes, that was a very striking case because the attorney asked them through the interpreters how he came to the United States, what his story was, to see what actually was the background of his case. And when asked how he came to the United States, he answered, "I walked." And we looked at each other. The attorney thought that maybe I was misinterpreting. So we asked again, "What do you mean?" And he said, "I walked for a month and 10 days until I crossed the river." So he actually walked all the way from Guatemala across Mexico by himself until he crossed the border alone, and then he gathered with other, he met other immigrants and hitchhiked rides on a truck to Dallas and then to Postville. So we understood how desperate his family situation was. There were many in that same predicament. They were basically begging to be deported. Of course, what made this case unique was that for the first time, at least in this scale, they were not being deported, but actually criminally prosecuted and sent to jail for 5 months or more. And the fact that they did not have a right to bail, and that if they wanted to plead not guilty, they would have had to wait possibly longer, up to 6 or 8 months in jail without bail, waiting for a trial, made this situation very, very difficult to really say that, that there was justice done in many of these cases. Even though I can tell you individual cases, the truth of the matter, and I will, the truth of the matter is that they were all treated exactly the same, with the same plea agreement. There was no case-by-case review, no circumstances, individual circumstances reviewed. So basically, the innocent and the guilty were all bunched together.
You describe, Eric, you describe one man just weeping through it all. You say that he just said,
yes,
he was nobody.
Yes. This was the first interview, and it lasted 3 hours. For most of those 3 hours, this man was just weeping. And he was weeping for his family, for worried about his children. He had children back in Guatemala, his mother, his wife, and his sister, all depending on him. He was the sole earner for the entire family. And one of the burdens of the interpreter is that in order to really be able to interpret accurately and convey the meaning and the spirit of the meaning that each person says, you really have to put yourself in their place. You have to become them, so to speak. And when I became this man so I could interpret for him accurately, I was placed in the position that he was in. And I found it, quite frankly, to be an intolerable burden. Basically, I saw immediately that this man had no choice but to plead guilty if he wanted to return to his family as soon as possible. after 5 months in jail and then at least another month for deportation. So I could immediately see myself in that situation, and I realized that this man, just like many others, women as well, parents, would be placed in jail for these 5 months, and every waking hour they would be consumed by the worry as to whether their family was going to make it, as to whether any of their children was going to make it that day. And on top of that, they would have to carry the burden of having failed their families. So to me, that situation, which was, I think, could have been foreseen and should have been foreseen by authorities, because they are experienced in this, so they know, they must know, and it is their business to know, that many of these Guatemalan and Mexican people have families in their countries and children depending on them, as well as in Iowa, in the United States, in Postville in this case, such that to place them in that position, basically holding their family's well-being ransom over their heads in order to induce them to accept a plea agreement and plead guilty as the fastest way to get back home, and then placing them in jail for that time under that kind of duress. I think that it's very disturbing. It's very disturbing.
Professor Kamaid, you took the unusual step of breaking a code of confidentiality among legal interpreters. You've been doing this interpreting for almost a quarter of a century. You're a professor of modern languages at Florida International University in Miami. Why did you do this?
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm a professor of interpreter ethics, so I knew exactly what I was doing and how and to what extent I could speak out and so forth. I do not advocate for other interpreters to do this. I think I was in a unique position where I had the duty to do this as a citizen and also as an interpreter. Let me say that I did not break the code of confidentiality. The confidentiality clause in the interpreter code of ethics is designed to prevent the interpreter from affecting the outcome of the case. Now, in this situation, the case was over May 23rd. The defendants had 10 days in which to appeal the sentence, and I didn't even begin writing my essay until the second week of June. So by that time, not only was the case over and these people in jail, but also the appeal period, the 10-day period for appeal had expired. So it was a closed case. So at that point, the confidentiality did not apply any longer. In addition to that, confidentiality is not absolute. There are other requirements, ethical requirements of the interpreter that override it many times. For instance, if you are a medical interpreter and you find out that a client has tuberculosis or another epidemic disease, and they tell you, please don't tell anybody because I'll be placed in quarantine and I won't be able to support my family. Well, you have a duty to report it because it's in the public interest, and that overrides confidentiality. In this case, there was also...
We have 5 seconds, Professor Kamaid.
Okay. There was also the requirement for me to notify about any impediment in the legal process as an officer of the court, and that's why I did what I did.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Professor Arkhamide Frasius. We will link to your report on what happened in Postville, Iowa. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.